Good evening, everybody. My name is Lena. I'm an alcoholic. Can everyone hear me well? There in the back? Cool. I would like to thank the group for offering me to come over and share my experience with this process of recovery. You know, primary purpose is it's really awesome for people to be in this fellowship and do know what primary purpose is, because I had no clue in the first 3 years of recovery. I'm really happy that I found it, I'm trying to make sure that when I work with people that they find about it a little bit, you know, as early as possible, as soon as they come into the rooms. So when I introduce myself as an alcoholic today, I no longer refer to alcoholism as my pathology, hopeless state of body and mind, which is also true, or was true at some point. You know, today when I talk about alcoholism, alcoholism for me is a spiritual path. The alcoholism gave me this incredible gift of breakdown of personal will. So it didn't look incredible, it didn't feel good at the time when that was happening, but in retrospect, I really can't see it in any other way than, you know, I was given this gift that helped me to experience the truth, which is a personal powerlessness. And it started really small. It just started with, you know, seeing personal powerlessness over a substance. I really couldn't see much further. And all of my process of recovery here in these rooms for just over 11 years has been really about seeing that powerlessness deeper and deeper, really permeating all aspects of my relationships with myself, with the world, with, you know, the fellowship, with life in general. And this is not what I thought, you know, recovery was about. I thought it was about learning control. I thought it was about, you know, coming into sort of realization of personal power and the use of personal power, and it's just the opposite. It's about through surrender and through letting go that we come to experience what is the source of real power and what is the source of really all life, and this fellowship and you know, everything that we get to experience here in this lifetime. So it's really, really cool, and I'm really, really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. Just this total radical change in perception happened to me. You know, when I came, I was a victim. I felt like a victim. I sounded like a victim, and my life totally reflected life of a victim, because that's how it usually is. You know, when, you know, our thoughts really do have the power to, you know, attract certain experiences, and I don't feel that way anymore, and that's really an incredible freedom to really be empowered through the process of personal surrender. Very, very not intuitive, you know, when the mind, you know, starts assessing these things, but that's how it seems to work. So I was born in an alcoholic country. So I have a lot of experience with alcohol. You know, the whole culture where I grew up was sort of, you know, just, you know, it was feeding on, you know, the drinking and, you know, all of the jokes involved the drinking. We had the vocabulary that you guys don't have that has to do with drinking. You know, we had a special word for, you know, like the morning drinking, which was sort of this medicinal type of drinking that was kind of authorized. So morning drinking was always okay. You know, we have a special word for, you know, like, you know, drinking after you acquired, you know, some material possession, you know, like a car or a new coat or a new watch or whatever. New notebook. That didn't really matter. If you don't celebrate that, you know, it's not going to last. That was a cultural thing. So drinking was really kind of a part of life for many people, and for me it was, you know, I was pretty much, you know, as long as I remember, I was like sitting there as a little child watching the adults and waiting for my time to be of age to drink. And of age meaning that, you know, when I could really just get a hold of the bottle, and when parents were not at home. We're not talking about legal age. When I look in retrospect, and I would never really put it in these terms, because I really didn't get any kind of self-awareness as I was growing up. And as a matter of fact, until, you know, maybe 7-8 years ago, I had absolutely no self-awareness. I would never be able to honestly tell you how I felt, or honestly, you know, tell you what was going on with me, because I was, you know, in this constant, you know, state of projecting some kind of image upon you to get your validation so you can make me feel better. But, you know, now having a little bit of a, you know, benefit of perspective, as long as I remember, I felt what's perfectly described in our literature as the state of being restless, irritable, and discontented. You know, from that was sort of my emotional climate, you know, like waiting for the other shoe to drop. There was constantly this like sense of, you know, some ongoing disaster was going to happen with my life. There was this sense of being on the outside, not understood, not being a part of, you know, different and anxious. And you know, and I see it in the behavior, you know, as I was sort of exhibiting as I went through life. You know, I was a really anxious child, sort of breathing at the top of my lungs really rapidly, biting my nails, picking my nose, humming, you know, constantly trying to sort of distract myself from, you know, experiencing this really unbearable state of being in constant agitation and constant, unhappiness. And basically, if I was to sort of, you know, to put it as, you know, what it really meant and what was the cause of that condition, you know, the way I see it today, it almost was the sense of, you know, I was put in charge of this, you know, of making this life happen. That's what I was, you know, taught to do. And there was this, you know, inner sense in me, which I would never acknowledge, but that was the truth. And I knew that I didn't have the power. So there was this disconnect between, you know, like I have this impossible task of, you know, making the life what I want it to be, but I do know, and as experientially we all know, that I have absolutely no control. Once in a while, the life tends to go in the direction where I want it to go. It's never exactly what I want it to be, and the mind steps in and says, you know, I did it really well, and, you know, sort of reinforces itself in the belief that I do have control. But in 99% of all of other cases, when things don't go my way, you know, that sort of gets conveniently disregarded. It's quite amazing. Like, I look at my life today, like, I'm not even living in the continent where I thought I would live. And still, somehow, you know, the mind is sort of trying to, you know, sort of, you know, maintain this illusion of control. So, you know, I'm sitting, you know, there waiting for my, you know, to become of age to drink, and, you know, such day comes. And, you know, what I can see, my relationship with alcohol was sort of experiential and very similar to how I was introduced to spirituality. You know, I was my father was an alcoholic. He committed suicide when I was about 5. My mom remarried. He was also an alcoholic of a different temperament, but, you know, drinking similarly. My brother was an alcoholic, and my mother was controlling their, you know, alcohol consumption. And my mother was sort of sitting and waiting, like, in which direction will I lean as I grow older? And, you know, as soon as I could drink, I knew that I would be a drinker, because I could see the adults. I could see my father, my stepfather, who was a very anxious dude, right? He was a guy who would never smile when he's sober, because he's, like, constantly in the state of he's constantly hangover, right? Or he's drinking, or he's hungover, and he's very unhappy. He would not smile. The spring, right? Like, you know, the depressed spring. And when he has a drink, you know, something happens, and, like, the smile comes upon his face. Like, I could see this relief, like, instantly in him. And I had a sense that it would have the same effect on me, and it did. So I drank for the first time when I was about 13 or 14. I don't remember the season. I don't remember even, you know, the age exactly. Sort of it's my rough estimate, because I really don't have much of a memory having to do with my childhood, because I was never really there. Like, I was never really present. I was not in my body. I was in constant, you know, the state of, you know, thinking of over things and running away from my own fear. And you know, there was a day, and, you know, somehow I think a friend of mine, my violin buddy, we played violins together in a music school. She somehow came in possession of this, like, bottle of really strong stuff, a pepper vodka, like red pepper vodka, really strong. Not only strong, but it's also very spicy. We didn't care. You know, the alcohol was really hard to get in the country where I grew up. And what I remember happened is, you know, like, it's not the first memory, you know, that I had of that time, but it's like it's the first really, really bright memory. Like, I really, you know, took a note at the moment. Two things happened. One is that this, like, never-stopping wheels of my mind gradually came to a stop. And there was this, like, buzzing silence, and it felt good. And all of a sudden, it was okay for me to, you know, not have to run away from what I was experiencing. There was, like, one thing that I really literally discovered, the thing that helped me to live, like, to help me to be within my body. And that really never happened before. So, you know, like, a mental, you know, note was taken that I'll do this as much as I can possibly get away with it, with this. And the second thing that happened is that I took the first drink, and it seemed like the first drink took the second drink, and, you know, on it went. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, my brother discovered me in a dry bathtub in a pool of my own vomit. And, you know, we all had a good laugh, because, you know, like, you know, that's how you're supposed to respond to, you know, people sort of mishandling alcohol. And so that was my initiation. And I pretty much knew what worked for me and what I wanted in this life. And you know, truth be told, there were different things that I was also interested in. You know, I was interested in relationships because they made me feel good, you know, for a little while. I interested in education because that made me feel good. It made me somewhat, you know, feel like I've achieved something. So I was pursuing other things also. But, you know, alcohol was always the primary. You know, if I had it my way, I would drink the same way I drank the first time. You know, if I had enough alcohol, if you know, I wasn't in some kind of, you know, situation that would could put control over, you know, how much I was drinking. You know, it's the first drink that leads to a blackout. I mean, I was a blackout drinker, and you know, it doesn't really, you know, I will not surprise anyone if I'll tell you the kinds of situations that I got myself into. You know, I experienced a lot of consequences that I didn't expect. You know, waking up with people I never met. Until that morning. And, you know, just, you know, I guess typical stuff that, you know, women get themselves in when they lose control. And I would lose control every time I drank, unless I was sort of physically restrained or there was absolutely no alcohol available. So, but, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, I had the allergy of the body from the very first time when I drank. And that's really helpful for me to see that, because when I came into this fellowship and, you know, 3 years later when I was introduced to, I was given some information to diagnose myself, I could see that, you know, the allergy of the body was there from the get-go. The very first time I drank, you know, my allergy responded to alcohol in a way that it developed a craving for more alcohol and there was no stopping point. And that was pretty much that was my experience every time I drank. And, you know, it's very easy to identify for somebody who is an alcoholic or not, because this seems to be a pretty straightforward point, except that sometimes people develop the allergy of the body over time. You know, sometimes people are born with that, and it's like, for me, it's a total no-brainer. You know, whether I want to be honest with myself or not, that's like, this one is just really, really clear. And some people develop it over time, and I do work with women, you know, and at some point we start talking and we don't necessarily, you know, have similar experiences. But then, you know, if we look at really how it was at the end of the drinking, you know, sometimes that becomes really helpful to us, and we see that, yes, the allergy apparently was developed because there was this no stopping point. Very helpful. It's one of the things that makes us an alcoholic. So I went, you know, in that, you know, merry way, you know, having this, you know, preference for, you know, the great tool of dealing with life, you know, alcohol. And quite frankly, from the very beginning, I knew that even in the country where, you know, the overwhelming majority of people did drink and drank excessively, I did know in my heart, I would never admit it, but I did know that I drank abnormally. You know, I did know that I had to, you know, as the moment people sit at the table, you know, and the first drink is being served, my attention is on where the bottle goes, right? Like the second one, it's, yeah, I'm obsessed with that. Yeah, I need to make sure that there is a certain amount of alcohol that I'll get to, you know, to put in my body, otherwise I suffer. You know, I do notice how much people drink. I do notice whose drink I can finish, right? I sneak out drinks. I steal alcohol. I store alcohol. I'm very dishonest with that. And I do know that. But you see, for as long as alcohol is working as a solution, it doesn't really seem to matter. There is no, like, pressing need to necessarily acknowledge it. And, you know, and I went in this state of denial for about, you know, 20 years. So the next 20 years I'm drinking. You know, there is a marriage that falls away. There are some, you know, schooling. I was in school until the age of 35. Like, I don't know what was that about. I was just really afraid of facing life. I just couldn't, like, really just, you know, we can be done with school now, so let's just, you know, get a job. But, you know, it just seemed too much. Like, life seemed too intimidating. And when I was 25, and I'm still living in that country of Russia, and, you know, one of my favorite things to do there, you know, is to sit in the kitchen and, you know, pass on a bottle of usually warm vodka. We didn't have this glamour of ice cubes and glasses. And we would, you know, sit in the kitchen and pass it and share about how not free we were and how, if only we had the opportunities that you guys have here in this country, like, you know, like a freedom of speech and freedom of, you know, of education and travel, and economic opportunities, like how we wouldn't really need to drink that much. So, and here I am, 15 years later. I'm sitting in my own kitchen in Hoboken. I got sober in Hoboken. So I, great alcohol, you know, expensive, whatever, tequila, ice cubes and all, you know. and I can't put it down, right? And I know that, like, I can't really, like, you can only really deny it for that long, and I know that I'm done. Like, I know that this thing has absolute control over me. The freedom that I was hoping I will get, you know, because I changed the continents, it's not coming. And in fact, I'm much less free than I was at 25 when I didn't quite develop the mental obsession to the point where I needed to drink every single day. And that was a really, really hard thought. And I can see that from that point, from sort of that, you know, I guess, unidentified night. I don't know when that was happening, you know, the year, the season, nothing, because everything is kind of a blur at that point. I can see how something started shifting. Like, there was a moment of clarity that was there, and something started slightly shifting. And the first thing that shifted is I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. At that time, I was living with somebody who needed it. So, you know, I came to a meeting, and, you know, and I sat there, and I was very closed, and I judged every single person in the room just for the way, what I couldn't really make it is how people could really talk about these things honestly. Like, how can people admit that they have problems? Like, what about, you know, the perception? Like, how are they going to be perceived? Don't they care at all? So I was, you know, sitting and, you know, drunk, by the way, right? Like, at all meetings, I'm sitting there, I'm drunk, I'm judging all of you. But at the same time, I can't help, you know, there are, you know, people that come in and tell their stories, and I go through this mental checklist, especially if it's a woman roughly of my age, I can't deny, you know. And if a story that's told openly, it has incredible power of identification, even if I want to stay in complete denial. And, you know, and something started happening, you know, something started happening. You know, at that point, it's about, I would say it's probably 1999, maybe fall, and I start going to meetings, and I can't stop drinking. So I drink and I go to meetings. I leave the meetings that I drink. I wasn't underweight. I was like more like overweight because I was trying to find all of these ways to drink so that, you know, you don't know that I drink, or so that I don't know how much I drink. So, like, I'm kind of chunky, and I have this, like, really, really long bangs, you know, weird color, and I'm wearing this, like, designer sunglasses, and I wear them, like, December to the meeting, you know, 7 p.m. meeting. It doesn't matter because, you know, quite frankly, I don't take them off at all. You know, when I go in the shower, I'll take them off. When I go to sleep, I'll take them off. I can't face myself at that point. I just can't. Like, I don't know what's wrong. I mean, I suspect that what could be wrong, but I'm just not ready to tell myself what's wrong. And I go through this, like, constant, you know, dance. Every single morning I wake up and I say, I'm not going to drink today. And then, you know, and somehow something changes during the day. I end up loaded. And I come back, you know, home again, and I wake up the next morning, and again I go through this, you know, sort of play of the mind. I'm not going to drink, but I'm believing in that I have that power less and less and less. And there comes a point when I wake up one morning, and something was different, and I didn't even notice that that actually happened until, like, you know, 6 or 7 years, you know, after that. But there was one morning when what was different, and it's very, very subtle, but I sort of talk about it because I think that it's really the essence of what we're trying to elicit here when, you know, we work with new people, when people come in. You know, what happened was, you know, I was going through this, like, dance of, you know, I'm not going to drink today, but, you know, but I'm still trying. I'm not going to drink today, but, you know, I still can't try that. You know, and then it comes, you know, I can't stop myself drinking, but I'm still trying. You know, I go through all of these forms of resistance to the fact that I can't stop. You know, I know that I can't stop, but I still continue acting like I can. So I haven't really seen the truth, you know. I'm still, like, moving through the, you know, I'm still acting like, you know, I have the power, even though I know that I don't. And that morning I woke up and something was different. It was very, very subtle. You know, there was this idea that came into my mind again, I'm not going to drink today. And there was it wasn't met with this, like, resistance or that enthusiasm. It's just, I just realized that, oh, but I don't have the power. Like, that particular day, there was nothing in me that would even try to make myself stop because I just didn't have the power. And it's really, really subtle because I just remember it just as a sense. And really, I mean, nothing really happened because, you know, in my picture of the world, there was absolutely no place for any other source of power than myself to help me. But I can see how, you know, from that point on, things started moving really, really fast. Because I keep on going to meetings because I really know the truth that I can't stop on my own power. you know, I haven't tapped into any other source of power, but I do know that I'm completely hopeless. And it's almost like, you know, in Bill's story, they describe this instance when it's the second time he goes to the hospital, and there he's given all of the information, and he knows that he's done, and he leaves the house, the hospital, and he says, he's like waiting for this insidious insanity of the first drink. Like, he's not even struggling anymore. He's not even trying. Like, he knows that it's coming. You know, there is this that powerlessness. You know, like, I'm going to join this procession of, and self-pity, walls up and all of that, balls starts rolling. But, he knows. And I knew, I was really graced with seeing that. That was actually that moment of the breakdown of personal will when my mind could no longer resist the truth that I had absolutely no power over whether I'll drink or not. You know, whatever it wanted, it has control. I don't. And something started happening. So I keep on going to meetings. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't really have a judgment about it. But, there was really no awareness of what the solution to alcoholism was in Hoboken at the time when I got sober. You know, there were lots of meetings. On a given day, you can go to two meetings. There was really a lot, and there was a really strong fellowship, and, there was a sense of camaraderie and, love and acceptance. I mean, all of the, fellowship points that, that are really great, that makes us what we are, were there. But there was no message of what it really means to be an alcoholic and what it really means to recover from alcoholism. So I go to the meetings, and I... I'm drunk. I'm not really pursuing much because I really can't stop. I seriously can't stop, and I know that. And I come to, one of the meetings. It was a Sunday. It was an Easter Sunday, and I come in, and there is this gentleman, and the meeting was a strange meeting. It's a beginner's waltz meeting. I don't know if you heard about it. The first steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Out of 12 and 12, never really getting to the transformative part of it. But the most bizarre part is that they actually have the new people under 90 days. And for me, it's like always 90 days, right? It's not even one, right? Under 90, they actually ask that people who have under 90 days, they share first. Which is like the most bizarre thing because I'm just never sober, I'm with the meetings, but I'm drunk, and I'm I'm blurring the things out. I really I have absolutely no control over what I say, so that's kind of the courtesy that I get, and I come to that meeting and my turn comes and I get into this self-pity. Litany of, I grew up in the country, they condemned God, and I don't know how to, accept what you guys can accept. I'm just so much worse off than any of you. And just all of that, all of that stuff. And there is a guy in this room who is a Catholic, and he believes that on an Easter Sunday, a miracle can happen. And I don't, but he does. And it just so happens that he helps me to get home at the meeting. He wants to talk to me because there is something that he feels I'm missing. And he's so right. and he starts talking to me, and he talks to me about his belief. He talks about, what Easter Sunday means to him. He talks to me about the transformation that happened to him. And there are two things happening as the conversation progresses. Well, it's not a conversation. I'm just sitting there. I'm really desperate. I know that I have a problem. I at the intellectual level, I am trying to accept his solution, but I really can't. And he's telling me all of these things with incredible conviction of a transformed man. And it's wrapped in the language that my mind is just not liking at all. And I have two things happening. I have this, my mind absolutely dismissing the words that he's saying. But at the same time, there is something that's being communicated to me, which is just the fact of his transformation. Not the context within which his transformation happened, and it happened to be Catholic, but just the very fact that he was a drunk and he's no longer drinking. There is something that was in him, just something imperceivable. Just like Abby comes to meet Bill, and he... and he looks at him, and he doesn't even know how to describe it. He said there was something different about his eyes, because you can't really describe the transformation. You just sense it. You just see it. It's like you're either affected by it or not, because Bill was certainly not affected by the fact that that Abby hasn't drank for 2.5 months, because prior to that, Bill was actually, putting longer stretches of sobriety when he was trying not to drink. So it wasn't the sober time that impressed him. It's just really the transformation that he could see. And you know, and what happened to Bill actually happened to me. So at the level of the mind, everything what that guy is saying gets dismissed. But at the level of the heart, there is something that's happening. And it happened to the point where when I came upstairs, I lived on the 23rd floor there, overlooking the Twin Towers that were to fall next year. I got on my knees and I prayed for the very first time in my life. I had absolutely no conception of what God that might be that I'm praying, because it wasn't Catholic God, right? I had absolutely no idea what I said and, you know, how to pray. I've never prayed before that in my entire life. But, you know, what was communicated is that I was done and there was a hope that maybe there is something. You know, I can't say it wasn't a belief, it wasn't faith, it was none of that. It was a hope that maybe there was something, because that was communicated to me by Tony, by that guy. And that was the last day I drank. I never drank since. And, you know, for some time I was sort of, you know, like what the mind usually does. You know, the next morning I woke up and said, well, I did it really well. How can I continue doing it, right? It just takes control for something that it really has no control over. But, yeah, my mind pretty much dismissed that, you know, unlikely coincidence at the very time when I got on my knees and prayed was when I was released from the obsession to drink. And I went my, you know, merry way of being a good AA member for the next 2.5 years, about 3 years almost. And I did everything that I thought I needed to do, right? I took commitments, I emptied ashtrays, I baked banana bread. But I really cared whether you guys noticed that I added walnuts to the recipe. And if you didn't, you know, I would be upset. So, you know, there was something that not completely unselfish about my service. And I couldn't really understand why that was. You know, that you know, sense of being restless, irritable, and discontented, even though it was sort of covered up by the new persona that my mind built up of a good recovering AA, there was something in me that knew that it was just somehow not enough. It can't be it. It wasn't really fully helping. And you know, then I sought services of a therapist, because I thought that's what we also do as a part of recovery. When I was 1 year sober, I was allowed to sponsor other people. And I would call my sponsorship style as a drama management. Like literally, you know, when you have drama, you call me and we'll try to solve your drama. And when I have my drama, I call my sponsor and we'll try to solve my drama. And we'll tell ourselves some stories that we don't believe, but, you know, they make us feel a little bit better for 5 minutes. And then, you know, I would come to, you know, my therapist's office and sit down there and talk about me and my problems and my service and how I'm being underappreciated and how my relationship is not getting better and how my boyfriend is whatever. And that continued for about 2.5 years, and then I just got really, really sick spiritually. I got really, really sick. I just got sick of myself. A couple of changes happened in my life. The relationship fell away. I lost a job. I opened my own thing. And I just didn't have tools to deal with that, because I was, you know, back to where I was, restless, irritable, and discontented, and there was no alcohol to cover it up. And at that point, I pretty much knew that alcohol was not my problem, because I haven't drank for about 3 years. Something else was my problem, and I didn't really know what that was. And out of that pain came another prayer. And I did pray, you know, when I was trying to be a good AA, I had a God box and lots of, you know, toys. And, you know, and I went to retreats, as a matter of fact. I even had a, you know, cushion from a real Zen Buddhist monastery. And I was, you know, I couldn't really sit much on it, just because I was so internally restless. I was just so not at peace. It was such a torture for me to be with myself for like 1 minute. Really, really painful. And my mind was getting crazier and crazier. And a prayer came out, and it went in the God box, but it was like the first true prayer in that, you know, almost 2.5 year period. And it was really a prayer of surrender, and it was even had more powerlessness in it than the first prayer. Because the first time I prayed, it seemed like, oh, I'm overwhelmed by alcohol. We just need to address this one problem, and everything's going to be good. And here, I didn't even know what to blame, right? I just had absolutely no clue how to live my life. Like, whichever way I will turn, whatever decision I make, whatever goal I pursue, everything was suffering. And I could feel it more and more. I would never say that, you know, I was suffering in those years when I had absolutely no self-awareness, because, you know, the denial mechanism of the mind was so good to really explain any situation, to blame any situation on somebody, you know, which makes me, even though I'm a victim, but still, at least I'm right. You know, at least I know that, you know. But now I really didn't have that, because you can only delude yourself for that long. And, you know, when they talk about the rigorous honesty, this is the kind of stuff that they talk about. You know, can I, do I really have a power to live my life? If I'm only relying on my mental ability, and if I'm only governed by what I want, can I really have a well-adjusted life? Can I have a happy life? Can I have a peaceful life? Because, you know, what I've discovered is that is what I want has absolutely no power behind it. Because it's that self-centered, absolutely disconnected from reality drive that is in constant clash with reality. You know, everything I do, which is governed by what I want, it's in complete disalignment with the flow of life. And I will inevitably come across it, and I will fight it, and I will argue with it, and I will lose. And I will never admit that I'll lose. You know, there is this something about the thinking mind and this, you know, self-centered motivation that's really, it's a really... It's the cunning, baffling, and powerful aspect of alcoholism. That's what it is. You know, that's it's hard to really see, because we're usually trying to see it with this whole thing that's creating this problem. We're trying to look at the mind with the mind, and that makes it really a not true seeing. It makes it a skewed seeing. So, so in goes a prayer in a God box that I have, and it's a true prayer, and it's basically the prayer. That communicates the spirit of, I don't know how to make life happen, right? I just don't know how to live. I don't know how to make decisions on my own behalf. I don't know how what's good for me. You know, for the very first time, like, I'm really questioning whether I even have my own interest in mind. Because I find myself constantly, you know, my mind is moving towards this, you know, imaginary goal, no matter what I'm pursuing. Like, one of the examples is, was given this incredible educational opportunities that you guys have here. You know, one of the decisions I made is, like, I want to go to law school, and I have this, you know, my mind built this whole idea what it means to be a lawyer, and that involves, you know, living in a brownstone, having a boat on the Hudson River, you know, having an office with an antique, you know, table and, you know, antique chair, and, you know, getting certain validations, you know, power. Of, you know, appreciation that makes me feel better, and enough money in my account, and you know what I really didn't care what that profession really entailed. I really didn't care about, you know, having to show up early. You know, I didn't care about not having uncertain outcomes. I didn't care about responsibility I have for other people. I didn't think of malpractice claims. I didn't think about anything. You know, I just thought about, like, I wanted to get to that image of sitting at the desk and having a brownstone in Hoboken and a boat on the Hudson River. Like, you know, and anything that would deviate from that would make me unhappy, because I wasn't prepared for what it really was. I never really inquired what that profession was really about. I really didn't. I didn't care about that. I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in pursuing what I want. And, you know, and by the time I was, you know, out of law school, which sort of happened to coincide with, you know, when I started getting some clarity, you know, the person who wanted to go to law school, who wanted those things like power and prestige and money, it was no longer there. And I found myself with, like, really with the burden of this profession, because that's not what I really truly wanted to do. And, you know, and I found a way, and I was conflicted for a bunch of years, and I found a way to be of service, and I found a way to, you know, pursue things that were, you know, in harmony with what I wanted. And, you know, and I chose certain... you know, so to do certain things that were, you know, that, you know, make my heart sort of, you know, open and make me feel happy, be helpful to others. But, you know, just these little things, you know, the mind really does have this tendency, you know, no matter what we do, right? Even when we go about, you know, working the steps, you know, the mind has a tendency of saying, all right, I know what that means, right? It means that I want to be happy, joyous, and free. And, you know, unawakened mind has certain ideas about what it means to be free. Right, I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to have as much money as I want to have. Or, you know, whatever it is, it's not it. Because the freedom that's offered us is the freedom from that thinking. It's the freedom from that goal maker. It's a freedom from that, you know, nauseating consciousness that always wants to put itself in control of things. And when we really go into this process of recovery with this motivation that I want to experience this or that, I'm not really doing what I'm asked to do. I'm not in here in this moment discovering, looking at what's true right here and right now. You know, I'm pursuing some imaginary goal like I do with everything else. You know, it's really kind of, that's what we're up against. It's really, it's the thinking mind, and it's this, you know, way of going through life governed by what I want. So a prayer goes in the box, and it gets answered. So there's somebody who shows up, and you know, with a flyer, and it's a big book study, and it's a late Howard G. from Berkeley Heights group in New Jersey is doing the study with a couple of his sponsees, and it's in Bayonne, it's close to where I am, and I go, and I'm very, very much skeptical. You know, even though my prayer is being answered, I really don't know that I'm not necessarily going along, because there is something that needs to, again, you know, I need to be sort of this extra convinced that it's something that I would be interested in. You know, I'm negotiating, which is, I mean, that's what unawake mind does. You know, it just becomes an obstacle to spiritual growth. And, you know, it's helpful now to know that. But, you know, at that time, I really didn't. So, you know, I go to this, you know, study, and, you know, people go through the work. People have the transformation. You know, I have none of that. I'm just sitting there because I'm just like, you know, if I'm, you know, whatever. The mind comes up with a lot of nonsense. It doesn't even, you know, it's not even really fair to even honor it. And then something happens the last session when they start talking about the man's stage, and the person, Howard G., shares his experience with something that, you know, my mind determines is like, well, that's a fairly dramatic thing that happened to him. And he talks about it with such incredible freedom that I can't not sense it. You know, there is something, like, I really notice that there is really something in this. There is some transformation that's being mirrored to me that I'm not experiencing. And, you know, and from that moment, I was like, I'm in. Like, I know that there is something in this process, and I'm in. And even though I already, you know, didn't take advantage of this opportunity to go through the steps as a group, you know, I seek out, you know, Howard's home group. I go there, and there are a lot of women. And I start hearing things I've never heard before. You know, for the very first time, I hear that, you know, alcohol is not my problem. Alcohol was my solution. So there is something else that's my problem. For the very first time, I hear what it means to be an alcoholic. For the first time, I hear about allergy of the body and obsession of the mind. And things, you know, start making sense to me, right? I hear things that really ring true. And I can also, you know, I have, you know, very young and maybe not very experienced, but really beautiful, transformed, you know, sponsor who is really helping me to see, you know, my experience in light of all this new information and what happened to me in light of this information. And we go through the process, and many things change. And, you know, and I work with a lot of people, and I can see how people experience, you know, have sometimes significant experiences, you know, during the third step or definitely the fifth step, definitely eighth, ninth step. I really didn't have much of that going. And, you know, I'm not here to question why, but when I started working with other people, it just absolutely exploded. It just absolutely exploded, and there is something. It was the first time that I noticed working with other people that there is something that's happening through me. Now, there is something that operates that I can't control, I don't want to control, I get to trust more and more, and something that really has a real response and real influence. And I never had that before. You know, like I was of the mindset where, you know, I go into such a situation and I need to be prepared, right? I need to know what I'm going to say. I need to know how you're going to respond. I need you to get better. You know, just sort of the mind's, you know, stuff. And, you know, here I show up and what starts happening is that, you know, I have absolutely no agenda. And I don't even feel that you need to be different. I'm not lost in the role of being a helper and you being a helpee. It's not happening. There's something happening that's bigger than me. And that's where I think, you know, that hope started being sort of transformed into more of a faith and belief and then knowledge, right? Because, you know, like, I mean, today I don't need to really, you know, I don't even use the word belief. I don't believe in God. I know myself to be that power and the product of that power. It's like, you know, the same way as I know my breathing in the same way I know my heartbeat. You know, I don't need to believe in my heartbeat. It's just another tangible reality. It's that part of that source of life that lives itself through all of us. That's what started happening to me, you know, through this process. And I would say that most of the growth and most of the, you know, spiritual interest, it really was stimulated by working with other people and then with groups of people. You know, when I was four or five years sober, which is very small, and just recently through the steps, you know, I was invited to participate in Big Book work groups as a part of Berkeley Heights meeting. Our meeting used to have this format when you go through the first 164 pages, we read through them and we share the material, and then we do 6 weeks of back to basics, we used to call them. They're not exactly back to basics, but sort of similar format things. And we invite, you know, everyone who would like to come from whatever fellowship, anyone who would like to have a transformation, and we would, you know, facilitate a work group. And I was given an opportunity to participate in those, and then I was, you know, I did, and I am continuously doing many of those, you know, with the groups outside of Berkeley Heights group. And I would say that, you know, most of the growth that I've been experiencing has come through, you know, working with other people. So it's really incredible how it works. So I went through the process the first time, and it was, you know, a little bit in the spirit of, you know, what I want and how I want to feel. It wasn't necessarily very deep, transformative. And then later I went through the process of the steps again, and you know, now I would say that, you know, whenever I work with somebody, if it's through the book, it is pretty much a joint experience. You know, I always get to some truth about myself mirrored to me through somebody, through the person that I work with. It almost never happens that to some extent I don't see something for me to see. And I came to really view this process of working the steps as a sort of a gradually empowering process, which comes as a result of giving up personal power. Absolutely different from how I thought it worked. Right? It's through letting go of illusion of control, because we never really had real control. We don't have real control. If we're to be honest about it, you know, it's through giving up that control, that illusion of control, that we come in possession of incredible power. And the more we see our powerlessness, the more power we actually have. And it's really quite amazing to see that there is this incredible intelligence that seems to be living itself through these minds, bodies, and it knows what it's doing. And it is incredibly intelligent, and it is benevolent in its really in its essence. It is, if we don't apply to you know, to this our human definition of what's good, right? You know, the human definition of what's good, it would be something that makes me feel good, right? And you know, what doesn't make me feel good, that's bad. You know, that self-centered definition, it doesn't necessarily apply to how the process of awakening seems to happen. You know, it seems like in the process of awakening, the life is constantly giving us what we need to wake us up to the truth of something that we're not seeing. So whenever I experience pain, or, you know, emotional pain, or, you know, I don't talk about physical pain necessarily, you know, whenever I'm brought to that point where, you know, I'm in pain, I know that I'm struggling, that there is some aspect of reality that I'm coming against, that I'm not willing to let go. And I know that, you know, that's really the teaching. So whenever I'm stuck, there is a teaching. When there is a you know, flow of things and everything's, you know, really good, it's easier to fall asleep in those moments and just lose that sight of what's really happening. But it really seems to me that the only motivation of life is to wake us up. And it will necessarily need to come to experience severe resistance with life. And in my case, it started with my relationship with alcohol, to see that. And, you know, but the beauty of this process of the steps is really that, you know, we come into this through forced surrender, you know, the surrender that we didn't plan on, we didn't want it, we didn't perceive it as anything good, it was completely forced, right, absolutely outside of anything in us that wanted it. But we're being brought to this place through the process of the steps of want of more surrender, of an ability to go through voluntary surrender. You know, when something comes, there is an opportunity for us. And that's what we do through all of the skills, the tools that are given to us, that are built in the steps. You know, the fourth step is really, the resentment is really nothing else than, you know, looking at all of the ways in which we argue with what is. What it is. You know, I think that I have a better plan. I think that universe is obviously mistaken. You know, I think that, you know, this shouldn't be happening, right? You know, that's the essence of the resentment. And that is just, you know, an argument with reality, right? And when I argue with reality, I lose, but only always. And that's, you know, when we really take it for real, that, you know, there is never a justifiable resentment. Why? Because it happened. But I didn't want it to, but it did. But it shouldn't have, but it did. But it shouldn't have, but it did. Like, we cannot win here. It's just sane to let go, right? It's not a good, you know, it's not the matter of, you know, good or better or worse, you know, moral code. It's just, it's sane to let go and not resist to something that's very clearly is going to prevail. You know, like, you know, the way people are acting or, you know, even, you know, my relationship with myself I came to see was very contentious because, you know, I thought that I needed to make myself into this person who act certain way and look certain way and who is never makes a mistake and who never develops a resentment and who is really, you know, in no way, you know, demonstrates, you know, their human conditioning. And, you know, what I came to see that it's impossible because that's just not how things are, you know, because I was born in a body, because I'm living on this earth, I will be, you know, doing certain things that I will never be beyond, you know, ever apologizing for being an, you know, having acted incorrectly, and that's one of the things that I'm invited to accept, right? That's one of the things that will happen. I never had that relationship with myself. I really thought that I was in control of my life. You know, I really thought that I could change myself just like I could change the world around me. And the more I live, the more I see that, you know, I don't even have a power to shut off my mind, right? If you ever meditated, I mean, you know what I'm talking about, right? There is no such thing as just sitting on a cushion and just shutting it off. Well, what does it tell us about how much control we have over the mind? And I also know, you know, if we really have control, then, you know, why don't we make a decision to never have a thought of alcohol? Problem solved. Doesn't happen that way, right? Or, you know, I will never have a thought that causes anxiety. Or, you know, on the other side of it, you know, I've never had a plan to, like, sit down and just beat myself up for 15 minutes for some, you know, stupid thing that my mind talked me into doing. Never, ever did I have, did I have such a plan. So there is something that's happening that's much more or less in my control, much more spontaneous. And that was really, really interesting for me to see, because if that's really the truth, then, you know, I mean, who is even living this life? Because all of these decisions that come from out here, they seem to be just as spontaneous as any other thought that I have. Now, what is that I can really, what is I'm trying to take responsibility for if I'm not the author of any of the thoughts that I have? And that's really is the beauty of it, you know? Like, just, you know, and just being honest, right? This is just a little bit of a flavor of, you know, what they talk about when they talk about rigorous honesty. It's not about, you know, oh, I'm no longer lying because I'm not drinking, you know, that I drank or didn't drink on that day. It's really kind of, it's a surface kind of thing. It's more about, am I honest with myself as to, you know, what's happening here in this moment? You know, when I'm, you know, arguing with life or something that's happening that I don't like, I mean, what's the truth here? The truth here is that I'm trying to overcome the force I have no power to overcome. And that's insane. And I know that, you know, there is a, you know, and that's the reason why this is given me, is to break down that resistance over and over and over and over again. And in that resistance is incredible peace. And in that resistance we find the promises really flowering, but not in the sense that the mind, they can even be understood by the mind. You know, the freedom is the freedom from the mind. You know, is the freedom from this, you know, constant force to get what I want. It's the freedom to really allow living into the discovery of what is, in the state of listening to what's wanted. Not what I want, not imposing the will upon life, but discovering what does life want. You know, what's a natural movement here? Living in the state of essential and not knowing what's going to happen any moment, because we really don't have any control over it. We don't have absolutely no knowledge about what's going to happen this next moment and moment after. The only thing we know is that we'll die. That's the only thing we know about life, is that we will die. We don't know absolutely anything else. And it's just settling into this sense of trust and unknowing. That's where the freedom is, the freedom from the need to know. And that was really, really new, really, really revolutionary for me. And it's so much more than what I ever expected this program to give me, because, you know, when the me has a plan, you know, it sort of seems to know what it wants, but it never does. And it doesn't, and in fact, I do know that I don't know what's best for me. I don't know what's in my best interest. So I really have the power today to leave it up to the universe. And that's a way of living through real source of power, because it does know what it's doing, unlike the limited mind. I can't quite see what it says over there. Oh, is it? Okay, great. So I'm almost right. I need a new prescription. So, all right. So I do appreciate for you know, allowing me to an opportunity to come over and talk a little bit my experience with this process. It seems to be constantly evolving. So, you know, it just seems like, you know, every time I speak, it just comes out a little bit differently, and that's, I think, is a part of the game. You know, I'm sort of not trying to be consistent in the message. I'm just trying to be true to what's here right now, and I guess that's how it went today. So thanks so much.